Hello, and my voice cracked. Hello, and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host and the podfather of your favorite hebdomadal podcast. Oh, I'm glad you're with us. I'd suffer the effects of chondrodermatitis nodularis helicus if I heard that you missed this week's show. Here's our associate producer, Kate, with what's on the menu.
Hello, Tony. I hope that was so funny.
My voice cracks like I'm 14.
Hey, Tony. I hope our listeners are hungry. The state of the sector. Beginning with AI. This year, any conversation about the nonprofit sector finds its way to artificial intelligence. So we start there with our contributors, Jean Takagi on legal and Amy Sample Ward on technology. Amy is concerned about our lack of security readiness and shares their top five security must-haves. Jean explains your board's duties around tech, budgeting, and planning. They both see resilience as critical, plus a ton more. Jean is principal attorney at Neo Law Group, and Amy is the CEO of N10. On Tony's Take Two.
Tales from the Gym, the cure for dry eyes.
Here is the state of the sector, beginning with AI.
It's a pleasure to welcome back Jean Takagi and Amy Sample Ward, our contributors to Nonprofit Radio. Jean is our legal contributor and principal of NEO, the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group in San Francisco. He edits that wildly popular nonprofitlawblog.com. The firm is at neolawgroup.com, and he's at GTAC. Amy Sample Ward is our technology contributor and CEO of N10. They were awarded a 2023 Bosch Foundation Fellowship, and their most recent co-authored book is The Tech That Comes Next, about equity and inclusiveness in technology development. You'll find them on Blue Sky as Amy Sample Ward, aptly named. Welcome. Good to see you both. Jean, Amy, welcome back.
Good to see you both as well. I actually got to see Jean in person this week, which was a real treat. But both of your faces coming through the internet is awesome.
Where did you see each other?
In D.C. in a meeting.
Oh, cool. All right.
Yeah, it was wonderful to see Amy and hear a little bit more about her family and learn about things going on. And great to see you too, Tony.
Thank you. Last time we were together was the 750th.
That's right.
Yes. All right. So Amy, you have lots of conversations with funders, intermediaries, nonprofits. I'd like to start with you. Just what are folks talking about?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of desire for thoughtful conversation across the sector right now and over, you know, the last handful of months, and I'm sure the months to come. And that desire for thoughtful conversation is trying to be held in a time where things feel rapidly unraveling, you know? And a few, I think, patterns have been coming up, at least in the versions of conversations that I'm in, whether those are, you know, one-to-one with other intermediary organizations, capacity building organizations, nonprofit service groups, or even philanthropy serving organizations, or with funders themselves. And they're, of course, different, you know, flavors of the same dish maybe, but I think everyone really wants to hear and help. And it feels like there's not that much help happening.
So, like, when you talk to funders, can we, how are your These are foundations, I presume. We say funders, you're talking about foundations.
Yeah.
How does that go? Like, you should be funding technology, you should be funding capacity building, you should be funding general operating support. Like, are you advocating for those things, or?
Yeah, we are always.
How come you don't? Why don't
you? Yeah, I mean, part of what NTEM sees as our kind of theory of change and the way that we make impact is, of course, in directly supporting nonprofit staff through training, but also shifting the conditions in which all of us are doing this work, right? So asking funders to fund adequately for the technology and data that is needed to deliver the programs they're funding, right, is part of that, or all kinds of other advocacy, big A, little A, you know, influencing okay. philanthropy.
So they take these meetings? Like, they don't mind being told what they ought to be funding?
Oh, it's easy to take a meeting.
The outcome and what's the action? I realize that. But
most of the conversations NTEM is entered into with foundations are not necessarily on the premise of, like, can you please give us this feedback to fund a certain way, right? We just say that when we have access to folks that we could share it with. But mostly, I think in these times, just like honestly in 2020, funders and other philanthropy serving organizations are asking for what we see, because we are able to see into a lot of different types of organizations across the sector, not even just in the US, and see trends that are emerging, see what folks are really asking for help on, right? In a way where we're not having to divulge, oh, this organization that's your grantee, they don't know how to do this, right? There's not that vulnerability. We're able to share trends. And unfortunately, the trends aren't new, but at least they're asking about them right now. And they are very vulnerable issues. Like, we are seeing incredible lack of security readiness in organizations. And as we've talked about on this show, and Jean has talked about, you know, there's a lot to be concerned about when you think of a nonprofit organizations like digital and cybersecurity, because it's your staff, it's your content, but it's also all of your constituents, all of those people who've received programs and services. And if you feel that your mission and your programs and services are vulnerable, those folks in your community who've accessed them are X times more vulnerable, right, than your organization is. And that's something that I think for us, we care about that kind of more than anything. And so it really has felt like a spotlight on security. And even just to illustrate, we kind of created a new program just to try to help in this way, a 3-month just security focused program. We had a single email that said that it was open. In 4 days, we had 400 applicants from 26 different countries asking to be in the 20 people, you know, cohort. So yeah, that was, I think, validation that we were really hearing the trend and hearing what's behind some of these questions that we're getting? What are people really struggling with? And oh my gosh, okay, we're right. They are really struggling with security. This is,
let's bring Jean in on security. You're nodding a lot, Jean. And yeah, and we have talked about, as Amy said, as they said, we have talked about it, but you know, it bears amplification, because we all have talked about cybersecurity, protecting data, but especially, as Amy's saying, the people you're doing the work for, if you're involved in people oriented work. Jean, remind us.
Oh, I'm amplifying everything Amy says, as I'm wise to do. But maybe I'll just add that, you know, when people think, including funders, when they think about technology, and some of them are just focused on AI right now, but technology is much broader than that, of course. When they're thinking about technology, they really have to think of it as one of the core assets of an organization. And that's not all, because it's also a huge risk and liability, not only to the organization, but to all its beneficiaries and its communities that they serve and its communities that they exist in. So it's all of that. It's even more complicated to manage, if I might venture and say this, than your other main investments, which are like in staffing and in facilities. Like, this is stuff that we don't have a lot of experience with. It's newer things that are coming up. We haven't learned how to manage it very well. It's a little bit out of control as it develops, as with AI going on. We don't even know what the laws are related to this. So this is stuff that funders need to fund and organizations need to invest in really badly. And when they don't think about doing this, they're really living for the short term at the expense of the intermediate term, because it's not even that far off in the future where these risks will ripen. They will ripen very, very quickly now. So
And
that's
just to
my two cents.
kind of add to
I
what
know.
Jean's saying, I talked to two different funders who are regional funders, not national funders, and said, "Hey, I know the folks that are your grantees. They're predominantly rural organizations. They're predominantly very small organizations, single digit FTEs. They're folks that we can see in our data, not as individuals or individual organizations, but by kind of organizational demographics, are very likely to have really low scores, in effectiveness in these areas. We have free resources. We're not even like asking you to fund us necessarily, like which I should have been asking, but coming at it from really, how do we get these resources available to organizations who we know are vulnerable?" And their feedback was, "Well, security's not an issue that any of our grantees have raised with us." And I just want to pause there because why would a grantee in the vast power imbalance between a very small rural two-person organization and a funder say, "We don't have a security certificate on our website. We don't have secure, donation portal. We don't have database protect." Like, why would they surface these
Why
security
would right?
issues
Why would
to their
they?
funder? Of course
Yeah.
they had. Of course no one has brought this up,
Why would
right?
they
To
admit
Jean's
it?
point, you need to be thinking beyond what was in that grant application and about really the safeguarding of that mission.
Not only why would they admit it, but it may very well have nothing to do with, although it's, well, it is related to what they might be seeking money for, but
It's not the
it's
purpose
not
of
a
that
part.
grant application.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's not going to be a question on the grant application. Is your, you know, do you have a secure fundraising portal?
Right.
Gene, you have some advice around board. Like, this should be at a board level CEO conversation, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's where it
absolutely.
starts to get started.
Yeah, and very obviously, like, technology comes up as a budget item, right, for the board. So when the boards are approving annual budgets, are they leaving any space for technology changes? Well, so many organizations, including public governments, are just like putting patches, right? They're investing in patches, and so they'll patch. But the technology is advancing so much quicker than patches can actually address. And again, the persons and organizations at risk are not only the charity itself, right? It's all of the beneficiaries whose data they've compiled, and potentially, like, just goes beyond that as well. So it's really, really important now for the boards to say, let's think about this as one of our core assets and our core risks, and figure out how we're going to properly budget for this item. And talking about sort of risk opportunity, you know, assessments, and saying, well, what happens? I'm a big fan of scenario planning, and maybe it's hard because these things don't have definitions, but over strategic planning for like a longer term plan, I think scenario planning right now is really important because the environment is just shifting so quickly, right? It's like shifting every few months, it feels like. So scenario planning for different scenarios. And some of that would be, well, what happens if we don't change our technology? Or what happens if we don't invest? What are the worst things that can happen? What are the likely things that are going to happen? And do we actually have board members who understand any of this? Do we need to relook at our board composition? Do we have anybody younger than 50 on our board? And for a lot of organizations, too many organizations, the answer is no, which will hurt you in the fundraising sort of pipeline down the road very quickly as well. We're not incorporating enough Gen Z, millennials into governance and leadership positions as boomers, and even Gen X are hanging on to positions longer. for a reason, for a good reason, but we need to bring more younger people into the pipelines because they have perspectives. They have a lot of what's at risk here as well. So that's kind of my thinking in with respect to fiduciary duties. In the budgeting, they've got to understand it. In the recruiting for board members, they've got to figure out how to develop the pipeline of who to bring in on the board. Like in their duty of loyalty, like to the organization's best interest, they've got to be thinking not only about the purpose or the mission of the organization, they've got to be thinking of the values of the organization, including how much they value the community. And all of this relates to the organization's what I'll call its reputation or its just legitimacy to the public. At a time when the government is poking holes at organizations' legitimacy, if you haven't earned that from your own community, fundraising and everything else will just dry up. So you've got to invest in legitimacy. If you're not investing in technology at this point and protecting persons that rely on you to safeguard their data, you're going to lose legitimacy really quickly, and you're going to be irrelevant or liable for
That's
what
all,
harm you've
yeah.
done. That's
Yeah,
all
I want to add
excellent. Thank you.
two quick things to what Jean's saying on the staff side, but then also on the board side. Plus a million to everything Jean said about making boards more diverse, including age. But I don't want folks to think that that means because you need to like have a 25-year-old on your board that's now in charge of your technology. The board's job is not to be in charge of your technology, but having more folks in that board meeting who have perspective or experience
Yeah.
with a lot of different things are possible helps open up strategic conversations to say, hey, have we considered this? Not that I'm now the implementer because I'm the board member, but it really does help. And I just want to draw that line that we're not saying make someone on your board in charge of technology, but having people comfortable with technology strategy conversations is very, very valuable, of course. The other side, on the staff side, one thing we see in our research and our different assessment tools and in our programs, yes, there are still organizations that don't have all the policies that they could have, right? They don't have strong data retention policy. They only think, oh, well, payroll files or HR files, right? They're not thinking about all of the data, all of the content, all these different things, right? We can have a big policy book and there's work to be done there. But the real area of vulnerability that we see is organizations likely have some policies, but they do not have staff fidelity to those policies. So you could like go through a checklist and be like, yep, data consent policy, data collection, but staff don't know the policies exist and they are not practicing them at
Oh,
all in a
yeah.
consistent way. And so I wanted to go back to the scenario planning note because I think we see some folks, yes, you could bring in a consultant or you could get some sort of big security like test going. But what you could also do is in a staff meeting, just take that time and say, right now, if we got an email that we had been hacked, what do we all think we would do? And just talk it through together and see, oh, this person thinks we would do this, and this person over here says, oh, we have an account here. What do we have? What is our answer, right? What are the questions we don't know how to answer? Let's go answer those questions for ourselves and really have more opportunity, I think, to surface with staff where people don't know something, not in a shame way, but in a like, gosh, this is what we should focus our training on, isn't just let's draft another policy. Let's understand how to do these things as the people doing them every day.
Amy, in a couple of minutes, after Gene and I talk about something that I'm going to ask him, then I'm going to ask you something. But I don't want to put you on the spot with no forewarning. Like, if we have, let's take a, our audience is small to mid-size, so let's go more toward the small. Let's take a 15 person nonprofit. I'm not sure it matters what the mission is. I don't want to constrain you. I want you to think broadly. I'm the CEO of a 15-person nonprofit. We've got a $4 million annual budget. Is that too high? Maybe $3 to $4 million annual budget for 15 employee full-time employees. What I'm going to ask you in a couple of minutes is what basic things can you name for us that we ought to have.
Okay.
Okay.
You and Gene talk amongst yourselves.
I'm being fair. I thought that was, you know, this way, you know, yeah. Yeah, you know, you're going to start writing. All right. Thank you. Gene, I want to ask you, let's talk about the core assets of a nonprofit. You staff, I love that you're identifying technology as a core asset. Are there other core assets that I'm not thinking of?
Well, staff is typically number one, right? Facilities is typically a pretty big investment, although that's been changing with a lot of remote working now and organizations seeking to downsize how they allocate where their investments are, where their assets are. Staffing is also changing in part because of some technology, right? So if technology isn't in that bucket in there, you may be downsizing staffing, you may be reducing facilities, but why is that happening? Probably somewhat related to your technology, if your funding stays stable. I know that's a big assumption, but probably technology is playing a part in that. Is your technology gonna break down like in a year? That's something to really think about. If you're now reducing staffing and reducing facilities, relying on technology that's gonna break down in a year, or give you problems in a year, or create harm to your beneficiaries, that's like the big one that Amy raised that really hits home for me. It's like, now you've got to really rethink, well, what was the board doing? Did you even think about that? So, you know, as part of your fiduciary duty of care, and again, I love to think of it in terms of both the mission of the organization and the values of the organization, which if I bring it down to fundamental human rights, it's preserving dignity to your beneficiaries, right? And if you're not safeguarding their private data, and if you're letting health data flow away, and this includes your employees too, right? Like your key stakeholders, if they can't trust you, then your legitimacy is also gone, right? So you're really just shooting yourself in the foot unless you're doing that. So boards have got to now rethink, like we maybe weren't thinking about technology that way so much before, but as we've seen how exponentially, you know, exponential changes technology creates for our organizations and the environments and what we invest in and what our risks are, boards have got to be in the mix. And I agree absolutely with Amy, it shouldn't be the 30-year-old or 25-year-old board member who's like, okay, you're in charge of the technology.
Yeah, no, right.
But it's another perspective in there.
Yeah, and it's better informed. Look, I'm the oldest person on the meeting in our chat. They're better informed. You know, they have a fluidity. They think about things that 63-year-old is not going to think about, or 55-year-old is not going to think about. So I'm just kind of fleshing out. Yeah, of course, different perspective, but how so? Because depending on their age, they either grew up with, you know, technology is an add-on to my life. And some people have had it since like age five. You know, I had a rotary phone at age five and I always dialed it backwards. So, you know, I was challenged from the beginning. All right, our colleague is looking up from her homework assignment.
Their homework.
From their homework assignment. What can you enumerate for us?
I have five things I wrote down off the top of my head. I don't know that if I had, you know, 50 minutes instead of five minutes, that I would write the blog post with these same five pieces. But I think all of them, I know you gave me an organization, kind of 15 people, 4 million, but I don't think any of these are unique to that organization. So I just want to say that at the beginning. The first is cyber insurance. I know everybody thinks, like, let's make sure we have our D&O in place. Check the box for cyber insurance as well, you know?
Let's make sure everybody understands D&O, directors and officers insurance, in case you're not familiar with that, that's an essential.
You should also definitely have that. So.
Directors and officers, thank you. Yep.
Yeah. The second piece I put down was data deletion practices. I feel like there's such a focus on preserving data and content at all human reason. But actually, like, to what end do you have this? Especially to Gene's point before about the dignity of people, They're not in your program. You're not reporting on them, to a funder. You're not. Why are you saving every bit of this if it means somehow that list is taken, And we talk a lot in our kind of closed cohorts when we're working with organizations that it isn't that we don't think there's value in being able to look at longitudinal data of your programs and, do that evaluation. But you don't need to know that Amy Sample Ward was the person in that program, right? There are ways that you could anonymize the data and still preserve the pieces that are helpful for your program, like evaluation, while removing the risk of it still being me or Jean or Tony, associated. So I really think deletion practices and policies that dictate when you delete things, how much of it you delete, what you anonymize is really important. Third, this is, I think, hopefully more top of mind for folks since so many organizations maybe became hybrid or virtual or remote permanently from the pandemic, and that's content and machine backups and redundancy. I see a lot of organizations who say, oh, but we use the cloud, right? Like we use Microsoft 365 or we use Google Workspace. Okay, but in your day-to-day, is every single document that someone's working on in those systems? And if they're downloading it to work on it offline for any reason, well, does it have data in it? Does it have constituent information in it? But also, like if someone's working on something and their, computer is stolen or broken or vulnerable, is all of that backed up somewhere? It's quite simple to set a full machine backup to the cloud every day too, right? But it just takes thinking of that, prioritizing it, and setting it up. So I think
And
that's
including with that, recognizing that employees might be using their own devices.
totally.
They probably shouldn't be. You should be, or you should at least be funding their technology, their monthly Wi-Fi bill, et cetera. But beyond just recognizing that they may not even be using exclusively your technology,
Exactly.
and what's the redundancy and backup
And I
of their
really
own
believe
devices?
that technology policies that say the only tool you could use is the laptop we gave you are intentionally limiting your own understanding of how those workers are working because there's no way that they are only using that laptop you gave them. So having a policy that says this is how you safely access our tools, whether you're using our laptop or not, at least allows you to build the practices, the human side of security into that use instead of pretending it doesn't happen,
Yes.
Okay, number four and number five are somewhat similar, but again, this is where we see big breakdowns in practice. Number four is that every system that can have it has two-factor enabled and is required. There's so many ways to do two-factor that it isn't an excuse to say that it's like burdensome. It doesn't have to be like, it doesn't have to be a personal text message. It could be an authenticator app, whatever, but like you need to have two-factor on everywhere. And need to be using a password manager so that staff are not sharing passwords with each other by saying, hey, Jean, the password to, our every.org account is this. Like, oh my God,
Is
that
password.
we can both log in, but it's encrypted. We don't see the password, right? We're sharing it in a safe way. And then the last one, number five, is that, again, a practice, organizations have established processes for admin access, for if you get logged out of something, that it is not, I email Tony and say, oh, hey, will you send that password to me? Like most of the security vulnerabilities that we see with organizations isn't because somebody was in a basement and hacked their way in. It's they sent one phishing email and a staff person responded and was like, oh, yeah, here's your password, right? Like it wasn't hard to get in. So if you have a policy that says you'll never email each other to say I got logged out, what is a more secure way? Okay, well, I call you on the phone. We have this secure password that we say to each other that only staff know. And like, I'm not saying that has to be your plan, right? But it isn't just randomly, oh, the ED sends an email to the staff person that says, please reset my password. Like, I don't think that's going to be foolproof, you know?
Okay, so it's just as simple as a procedure for what happens when
Exactly.
somebody can't log in.
Exactly, because that does
Okay.
happen. So why not create something where everybody on the team knows this is what we do? I know I'm doing it safely, you know, and following the procedure.
Okay, those are pretty simple. So you might say, well, cyber insurance, that's not simple. It's not like I can do it today, but you can talk to brokers, you can talk to insurance brokers for cyber insurance, data deletion policy. I'm going to venture that N10 has a sample data deletion policy and its resources. There you go. Backup and redundancy. Do you have a is there advice about that in
Yeah, there's lots of
or do you need
committees
a
talked
consultant for
about it,
that?
but I'll put it on our list to make sure that there's some guidance on that on our cybersecurity resource hub, which is all free resources. So I'll make a note of that.
Beautiful. Two-factor and password manager. All right, I think that's pretty well understood. I mean, I have clients that use the Microsoft Authenticator. As soon as I hit enter on the laptop, I can't even turn to my phone fast enough. The Microsoft Authenticator app is already open, notified. I already got the notification in the second it takes me to turn from one side of my desk to the other. The Authenticator is open. So it's not like there's no delay. Okay, and a procedure for not being able to log in. I bet you could find that on the N10 site too. All right. Thank you for that quick homework. Thank you. All right. So this is eminently doable. And then of course you have to go deeper. There are policies that you need to have, but I wanted something kind of quick and dirty. So thank you for that. All right. All right. Should we turn to just like general state of the sector from our cybersecurity conversation? Amy, you want to kick
Well, I
that
think
off?
the
You
other
want to kick
thing
that
that's
off too?
coming up
You talk to
is,
lots of people.
yeah, I do talk to lots of people, and I think, we're hitting the 2 year mark of God, the like unavoidability of people constantly talking about AI, which I have my own feelings about. But, if I step out of any one day's conversations about AI and look at the last 2 years, we're in a very different place of those conversations, in a way that I think I finally feel good about how the trend is going in those conversations. A lot of one-on-one calls I have with really diverse organizations, small advocacy organizations, global HQ, urban, like all kinds of folks, is how do we not use the tools that are being marketed to us? And how do we build a tool that's purpose-built, that's closed model, that's just the content we want it to have, right? And like actually useful for us, which I think is really exciting that folks are kind of seeing that it's just technology. Just like, yes, it has different capabilities. You do different things, different tools do different things, of course. But I'm really excited that it feels like folks are trending towards, well, we have some use cases. How do we build for those use cases versus we want to adopt these things? How could we find something to do with these things we want to adopt? Which I think was the reverse order of it all.
You and I have a friend who is devoted to this exact project, George Weiner, CEO, Whole Whale. They've created CauseWriter, CauseWriter.ai, which is intended exclusively for the use of small and mid-sized nonprofits. Limited learning model. Your content safe within it, and not being skilled in artificial intelligence, that's about the most I can say about it. But Whole Whale, and they're not the only one, I'm sure, but they've created a product specifically to take advantage of the technology of AI, but reduce a small and mid-sized nonprofit's risks around your use of it in terms of what it brings in and how it treats the data that you provide it.
CauseWriter, Change Agent, there's a number of folks in the
Okay.
community, trying to help organizations in this way, which I think is great. But
Now I can
one
charge
thing that's
George.
been a
Now I can.
trend, a smaller trend in the last couple months in these AI conversations, bigger trend, like I said, but there's also this piece where I'm hearing from folks saying that they can tell, for example, a colleague used ChatGPT, Gemini, a large tool like that, to make this proposal that they sent to them or this email. And when they say, "Hey, it's really clear that you used Gen AI tools to write this. Could we talk about it and get into like your thoughts more about it?" There, where they had in the past felt that folks were like, "Oh yeah, I did, but like here's what I was thinking." Now there's just complete denial that the tools were used.
They lie. People lie.
Yes.
Oh,
And
that's good. That's
right. And so colleague to colleague, they're like, "Well, how do we have strategic conversations about the way we use these tools if you're going to deny that you're using them?"
well, let's talk about what Jean suggested, legitimacy. I mean,
Right.
when you lie to someone about anything, especially as I don't know, it seems innocuous to me, but including AI. Well, I'll leave my own adjective out of it. I think it's innocuous. It's so the technology is so ubiquitous. But all right, if you lie about anything, you lose legitimacy. If I were a funder, okay, thank you very much. Goodbye. Because
Right.
you just lied to me about something that I don't think is such a big deal even. And I'm
And
giving
it
you a
was
chance
obvious
to,
enough that I
and
was
I'm,
able to point to it, you
yeah,
know?
yeah, yeah. And I'm giving you a chance to overcome it. I want to have a chat human to human. And you're denying that the premise of my question. Okay.
Right.
All right. All right. I'm shocked, obviously. I'm dismayed that people are lying about their use now. That's completely contrary to what the advice is. Ubiquitous advice is that you're supposed to disclose the use.
Right.
I'll just throw in there that,
Please, Gene, get me off my push me off my soapbox.
well, back to kind of board composition. If you asked a bunch of board members, I think many of them would say AI is just like one thing. They have no idea that like a AI is a million things, right? And you're probably using many, many forms already, whether you realize it or not. Even on a Google search, like, AI is popping up now. That might be a little bit more obvious now, but just to know that AI, if I compared it to a vehicle, for example, it could be an airplane, it could be a bicycle, it could be a tank. Right? They all have very, very different purposes and repercussions. And so you have to understand that, like, oh, we're going to like invest more in AI. That doesn't mean a whole lot. So to figure out what your strategy is, again, I think cybersecurity and when organizations are going to venture off into AI a little bit more. They've got to see it as a part of governance and not just information technology. It's not just a management tool. It's
All right.
part of their governance responsibilities.
It's time for Tony's Take Two.
Thank you, Kate. Got another Tales from the Gym. This time, two folks whose names I don't know yet, but I do see them fairly often. They're not as regular as Rob, the Marine, Semper Fi, or Roy. I've talked about Roy in the past. Not as common, but we'll find out. Like I did find out the name of the sourdough purveyor. You recall that just a couple of weeks ago? I'm gonna hold her name. It's in suspense now, but I learned her name. The one who gave the sourdough to Rob. So these two folks were one of them. The guy suffers dry eyes, and the woman he was talking to had the definitive cure for dry eyes. You have to try this, and she was on him for like 5 minutes. You got to try this. Hold on to your seat. Make sure you're sitting because you're not going to want to stumble and fall down when you hear the startling news of the dry eyes cure of the century. Pistachios. Pistachios. She was very clear. Quarter cup. She did not say a handful, which to me a handful is a quarter cup. She didn't say a handful. It's a quarter cup of pistachios daily. All right? This is a daily regimen you have to follow. And you will get results within 3 to 4 hours. She swears it. 3 to 4 hours, your eyes are going to start watering. It's going to be like you're crying and tearing, like you're at a funeral or a wedding. That's how much water you're going to have. All right, I editorialized that. I added the wedding funeral analogy, but she swears within 3 to 4 hours, your eyes are going to be watering. Follow the regimen. Pistachios. She was also very precise. These are shelled pistachios. You don't want to get the unshelled ones. It's too much work. Which to me, that's interesting. Now that's contrary to the advice that I'm hearing on YouTube. There's that guy on YouTube, the commercial that I always skip, but sometimes I listen. Dr. Gundry. You may have heard Dr. Gundry on the YouTube commercials. He talks about pistachios. He says get the unshelled ones because that way you won't eat too many of them because you have to go through the task of shelling them yourself. So you won't eat too many because too many pistachios, according to Dr. Gundry now, this is interesting. Too many pistachios is bad, but the right amount of pistachios is beneficial. But he is not as precise as the gym lady. He does not say, Gundry, you can't pin Gundry down. Of course, I didn't listen to his 45-minute commercial. So, you know, I listened for like 7 minutes and I got the shelling tip from Gundry. So he's not as precise as the dry eyes cure lady. A quarter cup of pistachios shelled every day. You're going to get immediate results. That's all. It's just that simple. Cure the dry eyes. Don't buy the over-the-counter. Don't buy the saline in the bottle. Don't buy the red eyes. Well, red eyes is a different condition. That's different. She doesn't claim to have a cure for that. Dry eyes. She stays in her lane. She's in her lane. Dry eyes. That is Tony's take two. Kate?
I like the specificity of the shelled. Unshelled?
Shelled? Unshelled. No, get the shelled. The ones without the shell. They've already been shelled. She's very precise because the shells are going to take up more capacity and then you're not going to get the full quarter cup therapy. The treatment is going to be lacking because you're not going to get a quarter cup because the shells are taking up space in your measuring cup.
Well, then my next question would be like salted, unsalted, Old Bay, no Old Bay. It's like.
Well, you should have been there with me. She didn't specify. I think just straight up. She didn't say salted or unsalted. That's a good question. You're going to have to go on your own. Let's say if it's a dry eyes regimen, then you want to be encouraging fluids. So I would guess now this is not her. I don't want to impugn her remedy, her treatment, you know, with my advice. Now I'm just stay in my lane. This is not my specialty. Dry eyes cures like hers. I would say you probably want the unsalted because salt causes more dryness, right? If too much salt, you know, you become dehydrated, I believe. So, but again, that's not her. You know, I don't want to add anything on to her strict regimen. Oh, and by the way, I heard one of the commentators I listened to on YouTube said somebody had Riz. I knew exactly what they meant. Yep, I knew exactly. I didn't have to go look it up in the I knew it. Charisma. I said, oh, I know that. I don't have to go look it up in the slang dictionary.
Oh, I'm so proud of you.
Yes, thank you. Just a couple days later. All right.
We've got buku buttloads more time. Here's the rest of the state of the sector, beginning with AI, with Gene Takagi and Amy Sample Ward.
Now, I asked about state of the sector, and we're back into cybersecurity. It only took about 6 minutes. We're 6 minutes into this part.
That is a great way to understand the state of the sector.
It took like 1 minute. And then we just talked about it for 5.5 minutes. So, all right, where else? There are bigger things going on in the nonprofit sector. You know, our federal government, the regime has found nonprofits that are complicit in terms of universities. I don't think it's going to stop there. We are, you know, quote, the left is under attack and in a lot of different ways, and that impacts a lot of nonprofits that do the type of work that is essential, you know, whether it's legal rights, human rights, simple advocacy, I mean, even feeding certain populations. So obviously immigrant work. Let's go to the uplifting subject of the state of the sector generally. Let's put AI aside now for 15 or 20 minutes and just talk about what people are feeling, what people are revealing to you. Gene, I'll turn to you first for this. You know, what are people concerned about? What's happening? What's on people's minds is what I more what I mean.
Yeah, I think the sector is still feeling the impact of the broader public being very polarized, and the effect of not only government actors on inflaming the polarization, but on media as well. And nonprofit media is not exempt from that as well. So really is about trying to figure out, well, how do we move forward at a time where it is so polarized, and where for many organizations, the government is acting adverse to where our mission and our values are, and they are affecting our funding and what's going to happen. So one of the trends going on right now, I see, is there's a greater understanding that we're not going to go back to the world that was a year earlier, right? We're not going back there. We're in this, what I'll call is probably a transitionary period. I don't think this period will last exactly like this either. But what's going to be next? What's forthcoming? Is it going to be worse? Is it going to be better? And what can we do now as nonprofits to shape that direction? Like, we can fight tooth and nail for everything right now. But if we're not, and by we, I'm including myself in the nonprofit sector, so forgive that indulgence. But if we can work towards a brighter future strategically, what are we thinking about instead of just sort of defending against every new executive order or every law and just trying to sort of fight on a piece-by-piece basis to just maintain scraps of rights that we can preserve? What is our future plan? So we're going to also see, with the diminished fundraising, we're going to see some consolidation in the sector, right? There's a lot of nonprofits out there, and there are going to be a lot fewer nonprofits in 4 years. So what is going to happen? So we're going to see more collaboration. We're going to see more mergers. We're just going to see a lot of dissolutions. And that's going to mean that a lot of communities are no longer going to be served. So what other organizations are going to pick that up? And if we have less funding to serve communities, do we need to find ways to do it in different ways? And so, back to technology, people will rely on technology, but that's not the panacea for everything. And I think collaboration is going to be a big part of it as well. So yes, there'll be some consolidation and some mergers, but there's got to be other sorts of collaborations because the need is just going to keep growing. But also trying to shape what we want in a sector is important. And to understand that we're not the only country that's going through this, right? And we are more and more in an, in this is one world and everybody impacts each other. And there are other very authoritarian countries that have really harmed their civil society and their nonprofit sectors, right? Yet there are nonprofits that continue to thrive in those sectors. What are they doing? What can we learn from them? What gives them legitimacy when the government is not giving them legitimacy? There's a lot to grow from here, evolve and adapt. But we are, and admittedly, we're in really, really harsh circumstances. So everybody is just sort of, running all over the place without any direction still. But I think there's more and more understanding that we're going to have to start to gather together and create some plans.
I really agree with Jean, and I'm also thinking about how we first started our conversation and how I said, I'm experiencing folks really wanting to have thoughtful conversations, even though we may not be able to even make a container for those thoughtful conversations because of all the pressures and the anxiety and the unknowns. And I feel similarly here in the way Jean has framed the uncertainty ahead, because I see so many organizations who have never, through all the ups and downs, even if they've existed for 100 years, have never had to say that their mission was political, because no one has ever said that feeding hungry children was political, or that housing people that don't have a house is political, or name most of the missions in across the sector, right? And now we're in a place, the last few months of the budget cycle and all of those debates made Snap and so many programs became something where we saw staff in the community saying like, oh gosh, well, normally I send a newsletter. Normally, this is my job. And now I'm having to defend that our organization exists and why we would exist and what our programs do. But I also think, to Jean's point, there's so much to learn, and there is so much we already know. We do know how to do our work, right? Our folks who are running all kinds of missions and movements are experts. And so even if we are looking at opportunities to collaborate, not just mergers and acquisitions or closing, but really collaborate in new and different ways, we don't need to enter those conversations feeling like we don't know anything. We know a lot. We're just looking for maybe new venues or ways to apply that learning and that knowledge. And I want to say that part because I don't want folks feeling like they can't enter those conversations because they've just never done it before and they don't know what to even say. No, you know all about housing. You know all about resource mobilization in your community, whatever it might be, right? And so from there's lots to grow from that there's already fertile ground.
We have, yeah, we have experience, we have wisdom. It sounds like, you're both talking about resilience. We need, we're I guess in the current moment, we're sort of treading water to see what's coming as we're defending our whatever our work is or whatever is important to us personally, because we know that we can't take on everything, but we're standing up for what it means the most to us as individuals and as nonprofits, and then we're waiting to see what the future holds. I agree. I don't think it's going to be this extreme, but I also agree we're not going back to the 2016.
Yeah, I'm just a really strong believer in one thing you said, Tony, about like what we want. There's some things we want, and I think that is true of most of the country. I think for a lot of things, we want the same thing, right? And fundamentally, it's dignity for everybody, and dignity for our own communities. So just trying to find that and showing how nonprofits further that goal and making sure that your representatives know that is really critical. So right now, our representatives just seem to be voting as blocks, right? They just vote along party lines and they're not doing much more. But that would change if en masse, like the people that vote them into power say, these are the things that really are meaningful to us. Like do something, about these fundamental things. We want to be able to feed our children. We want to feel safe on our streets. Like they're just fundamental things. And then we can talk about how to accomplish that. And we might have disagreements on that. But make sure the representatives know that they're going to be held accountable for helping people get what they really want and what the things that most are most important to them and that are meaningful to them. Because so many things that people are shifting the arguments towards have no real meaning to their personal lives, like attacking certain groups, for allowing them to have rights. Probably, the people who are attacking them, it probably doesn't make any difference in their day-to-day lives or not, whether those other people have rights or not, when we're speaking about certain minority groups. But why are they attacking it? Because that makes them, or they've been positioned. I think they've been, again, with technology and AI, they've been brainwashed into thinking this is the fundamental thing that separates us versus them, and we have to be better than them. And I think we've really got to get off of that sort of framework of thinking and really having nonprofits connected with their communities and tying them to their representatives is really, really important at this time.
Yeah, that zero-sum thinking, that everything somebody else gets detracts and takes away from me, mine, whether it's an organization or a person.
It's reminded me of a conversation we had on the podcast I'm trying to remember when it was years ago, years ago. And I don't remember what, if it was political administration change or it was natural disaster. I don't remember what maybe the original impetus was when we very first talked about this, but it is reminding me of, we've said before the value that every organization has in kind of sharing the information and the data and the lessons and the truth of your community and your work, so
I
that
remember that. Yeah.
when people are putting into the garbage machine, tell me the real, stats about hunger in my city or whatever. Who cares about that? But if they actually came to your website as an organization that addresses hunger and you said, these are the real numbers, right? This is what hunger looks like. It looks like a lot of different things, right? It's like AI, hunger can be all these different things. That's an important role in this time that every organization, I think, can be contributing, really saying, this is what we know, this is what we see, this we are experts on these topics, so that there's a little, even if it's a small antidote to the spin and the media and the wherever those online conversations go, at least you are kind of putting on the record what you do know and see in your work.
Exactly right. I think I remember we were talking about how to be heard when there's so much noise out there in the social networks and in
Oh yeah.
media. How does a nonprofit get heard? And part of your advice was you have your own channels.
Yeah.
So, and including your own website.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. All right. I don't
What are
know.
you hearing, Tony? You get to talk to people all the time too. You have your own angle. You're sitting over here grilling Jean and I. You got to
No,
tell
that's not
us what
fair.
you're seeing and hearing.
Gene, I hate when they do this to me.
Yeah.
So, Gene, help me out. No. All right, I'm going to put AI aside because there is so much of that. I don't. Still, funding. People still reeling from the USAID cuts. It fucking kills me that it's $1.5 billion, which. There are several thousand people in the world who could pull out $1.5 billion from their pocket and replace all the AI, all the USAID funding. See, I said AI when I meant US. It's ubiquitous. It's we're like we're conditioned that could replace all the USAID funding with a check, or with a crypto transfer,
Check
and they wouldn't
that
miss
could
it.
actually be cashed. Like, that's bananas.
And they wouldn't miss it. So. Yeah, people still reeling, missions still reeling from the USAID cuts. I have a client that's, but I hear about it from others as well. And it wasn't just USAID, but State Department cuts that were non-USAID funds. The State Department did a lot. A little in media. I listened to some media folks. Voice of America trashed under what's it, Carrie Lake, used to, like our soft, what's it called? Soft diplomacy, right? Like bags of rice, bags of flour and sugar through USAID and State Department. News and information that was trusted, unbiased. I know there are a lot of people who would disagree that it was unbiased, but still the effort was to be unbiased. Spreading news and information around the world, around the world. And then I guess also public media cuts here in the United States, where grossly, ironically, red rural communities are most impacted because they're not going to get emergency flood warnings like just failed in. Help me with the state. Was it Kentucky? The river that flowed and the camp that lost 20 counselors and children. Was it Kentucky? Texas. I'm sorry, it was Texas. Right. Thank you. Emergency warning systems, let alone news and information. We've gutted corporate media long ago, gutted local media. But just so news and information lost through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding. Corporation for Public Broadcasting, of course, winding down in, I think, September or October. So their funding lost. And even just as basic as, like I was saying, you know, emergency warning systems for rural communities, horns that blow, messages that get sent at 3:30 in the morning that overcome your do not disturb. Lost, you know, lost stupidly. And a lot of this, you know, we're just not, what aggravates me personally is we're just not going to see the impact of it, some of it, for decades. And we haven't even gotten into healthcare, but we're maybe not even decades, but just several years. It's going to take several years of failed warnings about things that NOAA and the National Weather Service used to be able to warn us about, you know, 8 months ago. And health impacts in terms of loss of insurance, lost subsidies around Obamacare, Medicaid cuts, and Medicare cuts likely coming. You know, we're going to see sicker people. We're going to see a sicker population, but it's going to take time. It's not going to happen in 6 weeks or even 6 months, but it will within 6 years. We're going to be worse off, and we're going to blame the current then administration, whatever form it's in. Nobody's going to be wise enough to look back 6 years and say 6 years ago we cut NOAA, and that's why now today in 2031 you didn't get the hurricane notice.
Tony,
and then, of course, healthcare too.
How about in fundraising, Tony? I mean, what I'm hearing is, don't rely on the billionaire philanthropists anymore. Like,
yeah, we're over. Thankfully, we're over that. I never, there's so far and few and far between, and 10,000 people, 10,000 nonprofits want to be in Jeff Bezos's ex-wife. Pocket. I can't remember her name.
Mackenzie Scott.
Sorry. Mackenzie Scott's pocket. 10,000, 100,000 nonprofits are pursuing that. You know, the focus on your relationships. Work on donor acquisition, but not at the $1 billion level. Work on your sustainer giving program. Work on the grassroots. Can you do more in personal relationship building so that people of modest means can give you $1,000 or $5,000. And people who are better off can maybe give you $50,000, but they're not ultra high net worth. But if you're building those relationships from the sustainer base up, working on your donor acquisition program, how are you doing? Are you doing with petitions, emails, and then a welcome journey, and you're moving folks along, and then you're bringing them in, and then inviting them to things? You know, work at the grassroots level. Among the 99.98% of us that aren't ultra high net worth, the other 95%, for God's sake, we've been doing this since 2010. Well, 2010. Yeah, 2010. 15 years, right? Yeah, 15 years, 750. Yeah. The other 95%, don't focus on the wealthy that everybody wants to, you know, the celebrity. I got a client with big celebrity problems on their board. Names you would know, three names everybody would know. They're a headache. They don't make board meetings. They cancel at the last minute. Last minute, like a couple of hours. After all the work has been done, all the board books have been sent, and a couple hours notice, they can't make it. And then another one drops out. Well, if she can't, then I can't also. As if that's a reason. And then the board meeting is scrubbed. And now we're, you know, now they're struggling to meet the requisite board meeting requirement in the bylaws. Right? So, you know, celebrities, you don't need celebrities. You need dedicated folks on your board who recognize their fiduciary duties, as Gene talks about often, to you. Loyalty, care. Is there a duty of obedience to? Is that one? Or that's the clergy. That's the duty of obedience. I know it's not celibacy. I know that's not included. Amy, why'd you mute your mic when you're laughing? Come on, let us hear you laugh. No, I know it's not celibacy, but loyalty and obedience. Loyalty and care. Sorry, loyalty and care. And what's the other? There are three. What's the other, Gene?
A lot of people add obedience in there following the laws and internal policies. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, obedience to laws and internal policies. Right. So, but care and loyalty.
Right.
That's another one. That's another one of these three celebrities. Giving to a charity that's identical to the one that I'm working with in the same community, does the exact same work, and major giving to that charity. So yeah, you know, focus on the 99.98% of us who aren't ultra high net worth. The grassroots. Yeah. Work on your donor acquisition and sustainer giving, and move folks along from the $5 level to the $50 level. This is how it gets done.
Things are hard, and there are things we can do.
Yeah, thank you. There are. There always are.
Yeah.
If we're focused in the right place and bring it back to artificial intelligence. You don't even need to use artificial intelligence if you don't want to. Amy, you've said this to us.
Right.
You don't need to, but that is not all of technology, and that is not all of your focus in 2025 and beyond.
Especially when using it is impacting care and loyalty and obedience and data protection and yeah. Everything else. Right.
Thank you for putting a quarter in my slot.
That really worked.
There's a lot going on, and there are things we can do. How about that's we end right. with that? Because that's up. That's upbeat. There is a lot you can do. There's a lot you know. Amy, you were saying. We have
expertise.
There's
so much you can do. There's so much you do already know. And that doesn't change because it is so hard. It just reinforces how important it is that you do know all of that. That you do know what you are doing. That you can take some actions, even if they feel small. Making sure two-factor is enabled everywhere could be the thing that saves your organization from being in the news. You know, like, that's worth it. And it didn't feel that big or overwhelming. And also, everything is still horrible, but you did that thing, and it was important to do.
Know what you know. You know, a lot of people, we don't know what we don't know. But you do know what you do know. Know what you do know.
Yeah, yeah.
And take action around what you do know. Whether it's two-factor authentication or talking to your board about sound technology investment, or it's focusing on your sustainer giving.
And
there's a lot going on. There's a lot you can do. Thank you.
And pat yourself on the back whenever you take those small steps, because they're probably bigger than you think.
That was Gene Takagi, leaving it right there. Our legal contributor, principal of NEO. With Jean, Amy Sample Ward, our technology contributor and CEO of N10. Thank you very much, Amy. Thank you very much, Jean. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
Next week, better governance and relational leadership. If you missed any part of this week's show,
I beseech you. Find it at TonyMartinetti.com.
Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. I'm your associate producer, Kate Martinetti. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy, and this music is by Scott Stein.
Thank you for that affirmation, Scotty. Be with us next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.